What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the show. Today we have a Q&A episode. I just wanted to say a lot of you guys have reached out to me saying that you left reviews on the podcast, and that means a ton to me. I've been doing this for many years now and never really asked for reviews, never really thought about it so much, but there's been some recent changes to podcast algorithms, and that is so freaking helpful. So thank you to everybody who left a five-star review on Spotify and people who left written reviews and five stars on iTunes or podcast app or whatever. Super duper helpful. Thank you so much. If you find value in the podcast, it means a ton to me. It takes only a second and really, really helps. Okay. Without further ado, too much waffling, too much asking for reviews. Let's look at some of the questions. We're doing a Q&A episode today. So thank you to everybody who asked a question. We're going to keep this on the shorter side. I'd like to do a couple of these a week. I think keeping these in that like 20 to 30 minute range, not making these like marathon Q&As would just make me maybe more inclined to do maybe one or two of these a week in addition to a guest episode or a longer solo episode. So let's jump into the questions. These are all anonymous. I have not read these yet. And so we will do our best to answer them in depth and give you guys some direction. Some of them, because it's an anonymous Q&A, sometimes I don't know if it's bots, but people ask like weird questions. So we'll start with the first one, which was a weird question. Next question. Any recommendations to help lower blood pressure? Absolutely. I think a boring answer is I would start by saying all the normal stuff you already know you need to do to be a healthy person. Don't have too much body fat. Do some cardiovascular exercise. Lift weights. Eat a diet of, you know, mostly minimally processed foods, high in fiber, not too many calories. That goes along with the body fat side of things. In addition to that, salt intake is very important. And I think most people know that. I would say that there's a variance in how salt sensitive people are when it comes to their blood pressure. Some people reduce salt intake and it has a big effect on reducing blood pressure. Some people, you know, reduce salt intake and it doesn't have a huge impact on blood pressure. So I would give that a shot. I think you should absolutely give that a chance without just kind of poo-pooing, oh, I'm probably not salt sensitive. Like, absolutely try that. That is absolutely something that you should do and give a fair go. I highly recommend buying an at-home blood pressure cuff. You can get one on Amazon. They're really cheap. It's something a friend of mine, Jordan Side, talks about all the time. Just it's something that people don't talk about enough. Calling blood pressure or high blood pressure the silent killer or like a canary in the coal mines, maybe that's hyperbolic, maybe that's like apocalyptic, but it's a serious issue that most people don't think about too much. I think we talk a lot about blood sugar and inflammation, and those are worthy things to talk about for sure when it comes to chronic health. But I think blood pressure is one that might go under-discussed. So I'm happy you asked. I think, unfortunately or fortunately, that there are, if you want to lower your blood pressure, get it into a healthy range, it does come down to doing like a lot of the really, really, really normal basic stuff. I think you could throw on the pile potentially looking at your caffeine intake. A lot of people in this country have way more caffeine than they really need. And that can be one thing that maybe might aid in reduction in blood pressure. But yes, I think salt intake is definitely one that I would look at. We are in a moment right now where, like, not to go on the salt, like, just go on a salt soapbox here or salt rant, but like, people are chugging down these electrolyte packets left and right. I mean, like, chugging, like, just to be clear, the recommended RDA of sodium per day, or that's redundant, but is about 2.3 grams, 2,300 milligrams. A packet of Element has 1 gram in it. Like, basically, I don't know, it's at 42% of your daily recommended. Now, that's obviously depends on the size of the person and how active they are. For sure. Just wanted to put that in context. Like, unless you are an athlete or training a lot outdoors, sweating a lot, you probably do not need to be chugging down salt water. Like, it's funny because I made a, I'd tell you guys a funny story. My dad actually works for, or did work for like 20, 30 years, a manufacturing plant back in New Jersey. His girlfriend works there now as well. And he asked me, he's like, and back in the day, they like packaged a lot of stuff for like companies like Herbalife. And like, they did some whey protein and stuff too. But he was like, oh, have you ever heard of this company called Element? He's like, we're doing a lot of the manufacturing, the packaging, that sort of thing. And he was like, you know, do you want to see if I can like get you some or something? And I was like, yeah, I would love that. But like, they're not going to put me on as an affiliate. It was like 2 days after I posted that kind of not anti-electrolytes. I'm like, being anti something lacks context. Like I'm anti electrolytes for the average American who's already having too many calories, too much salt, too sedentary, not exercising enough, right? That person does not need electrolytes. People are like, yeah, but I do Orange Theory four times a week, or I'm doing endurance training, or I live in a hot climate and I work out outdoors. And it's like, yeah, okay, yeah, maybe you'd benefit from this. I mean, you also might benefit from just salting your food a little bit more. So let's not go too deep into the electrolyte chat. We're 5 minutes in. I only did one question. This is not going according to plan. All right. Next weird question. Next one. Hey, Jay, I've been doing step-ups with dumbbells this cycle, but last week I switched to kettlebell and I enjoyed it more. Any ideas on why that could be? Yeah, just the way that the kettlebell distributes the weight can be more comfortable. And I think that that's totally normal. It is not a game changer in the sense that you have anything to worry about. I think kettlebells are quite comfortable just in the way that they distribute the weight compared to a dumbbell. Dumbbells are pretty comfortable too, but yeah, this is not weird at all. There's no downside. So you can absolutely use a kettlebell and that's totally fine. Next question. If you start gaining If you start gaining at what was once your maintenance, does that mean activity has changed or tracking needs to be tightened up? Basically one of the two, question mark. Yeah, I mean, a lot of things can be going on here. If you start gaining at what was once your maintenance, one of, let's say, three or four things is happening. Number one is you're a smaller person and you are referencing a maintenance calories that you were using that was maintenance when you were in a larger body. So you're like, oh, this was maintenance for me when I was 10, 15 pounds heavier. Yeah, it might not be maintenance for you now. The second is, yes, maybe you are more or less active than you were then, right? If you start gaining, then that would imply you are less active. So even if you're the same body weight, size, muscularity, body comp, you might be less active and you go to that maintenance calories and now it's a surplus because you're moving less. It could also be, like you said, that tracking needs to be tightened up and maybe you are, in air quotes, at maintenance, but that's you thinking that you're at maintenance. And realistically, you are referencing a time back in the day when you were maybe tracking more diligently. And now you are, again, in air quotes, eating the same amount, but in reality, you're eating more, even though you might kind of be loosely tracking around that amount. And the fourth is that, you know, maybe, again, on the more cynical side, is that maybe wasn't ever maintenance at all back in the day. Maybe you didn't do enough for long enough to really know that that was maintenance. And so maybe that's like so it's either your reference point from back then is incorrect or your reference point right now is incorrect. Or you are a smaller person now, or you are less active now. It's going to be one of those four things for sure. I would tighten the tracking up maybe like at some point, I don't necessarily always encourage people to track every single morsel. It's like, if you're tracking at a number that you thought was going to be maintenance, but it happens to be a surplus, the answer isn't always just track more diligently. It might be, but you might be tracking pretty diligently and you might be tracking with an amount of detail that feels really good for you. And you might be like, hey, I'm not tracking like cucumbers and freaking like the splash of skim milk in my coffee. And it's like, great, you might not need to go ahead and start doing that, but you might just need to accept that if you're not going to do those things, that we have to operate with kind of the facts at hand, which might be just lowering the number of calories that you're currently eating or let's say tracking to. Next, coaching question, but could also be helpful for listeners. How do you coach people who have such a chaotic lifestyle? Example, packed schedule, single parent, no help, tons of activities for the children, 2 to 3 kids, work, etc. I feel like they live in a constant chaos and it's hard to change. Yeah, it absolutely is. I think, first of all, everybody in this situation needs to manage their expectations. This is not a person who, you know, I think about that meme. It's like that 23-year-old kid who's like, everyone's got the same 24 hours in the day. And then it's like, you know, single mothers have entered the chat. You know, it's like this person and you as a coach by extension need to manage expectations. You should be managing their expectations. You should be meeting them where they're at. You should be, helping normalize the idea that they might not be able to turn every knob up to 11 right now. They might not be able to have, you know, the perfect workout schedule that they hit every week. They might not be able to work out as often as they can. So it's always everything you're doing as a coach is a combination of managing expectations and maximizing opportunity. Like you're managing the expectations knowing that, hey, this person isn't going to follow some 5 day per week, 90 minute resistance training program, you know, take 3 walks per day and meditate and have this mindfulness routine. it's your job to manage the expectations. It's also your job to maximize what they actually do have. And so making the most of the time that they do have, making the most of the mental bandwidth they have in terms of lifestyle adjustments, that is your job. Your job is to let them know, hey, like that's, you know, we need to manage expectations. We're not going to be, again, I don't need to go through the whole thing about training, you know, training 90 minutes for 5 days a week and maybe not even tracking every single morsel on a food scale because maybe they're cooking for, you know, cooking for kids and need to manage, you know, multiple mouths to feed and yeah, more chaotic and maybe tracking is a bit more just something that they don't have bandwidth for. But it's your job to find out what they have bandwidth for and find the best ROI lifestyle, let's say lifestyle and habit adjustments or improvements that they can make. And so that is always, I know this is not an easy thing. I mean, absolutely have coach people on a, with a, let's say a wide range of bandwidth and time, you know, everyone from people who are, who live a very stress-free lifestyle and have a ton of time to dedicate to training and ton of mental energy to dedicate to, you know, tracking and just this whole nutrition game, and other people who are like, yeah, I don't have time to, you know, spend 5 to 7, or I, you know, I don't have the mental bandwidth to track every morsel to the gram. And, you know, I'm going to be getting my workouts in more chaotically, more sporadically. It's like, yeah, manage expectations, maximize return. And so find those lower hanging fruit, big ROI lifestyle adjustments, and manage expectations. That's really all you can do. Next question. Been on and off a fat loss regimen. Oh shit, my dad brain is off right now. Been on and off of a fat loss regimen for a little over a year. Lifting heavy 5 days a week, still have to lose, but want to build more muscle. Would I benefit from a build phase, and for how long? There's a lot going on here. Here's the deal. If you want to build muscle at the most maximal rate that you can, go into a surplus. That's it. It's like, you're like, what I benefit from? It's like, I don't know. Like, do you want to build muscle at a maximum rate while also gaining some fat? Is that something you want to do right now? You know, you saying, oh, I've been on and off this like kind of fat loss pursuit for a while, like strikes me as like, yeah, maybe this person would benefit from taking a break. Like maybe it sounds like there's a little flip flop going on where you're like not really feeling like you're able to sustain that. And maybe kind of switching mindsets over to the build muscle, over to the like more of an abundance mindset, you know, feeling full, feeling satiated, feeling good, and spending some time on, you know, I think of it like paying into an account. You know, you're paying money into an account of muscle growth. Even if you're gaining fat, you know, you'll kind of get the dividends of that, you know, paying into an account later if you lose, you know, if you lose some body fat, and you can kind of the old reveal what you've built, you know, sort of scenario. So, you're like, I still have to lose, but I want to build more muscle. Would I benefit from a build phase? Yeah. I mean, I exhale and I pause for a moment because I just think people are overthinking this. Like, just sit here with me, whoever's asking me this question, just sit here for a second and think. A build phase is going to help me build muscle as quickly and as effectively as I can. But I'm also going to build some fat. I'm also going to gain some fat that if I, you know, kind of want to reveal this muscle later, I'm ultimately going to have to lose that fat later. Are you okay with that proposal? Is that something that you're okay with? Are you okay with those pros and cons? Like I don't want to project and assume you've been struggling to lose weight. I don't know that. But like if somebody's been struggling to lose weight, and I just mean struggling like emotionally or struggling with the habits and lifestyle adjustments, they don't really want to make those changes, I'm not sure I would recommend somebody gain even more fat that they would ultimately have to, or, you know, would like to lose later. I might rather see that person say, you know what, let's be at maintenance for a while. Even if that doesn't maximize muscle growth, it also doesn't mean we're kind of, you know, kicking dirt back in the hole of fat I'm going to have to lose later. And so it depends on a lot, depends on you. And, you know, if you're asking the question of how long, building phases are really simple. Go into a small surplus, something like 200 to 500 extra calories per day, aiming to gain about 1% of your body weight per month, give or take a little bit, could be 0.5%, could be up to 2%, but I like that roughly 1% body weight per month. So if you're 200 pounds, that means gaining 2 pounds a month. If you're 150 pounds, that means looking to gain 1.5 pounds per month. And again, you're tracking body weight daily, taking weekly and monthly averages. You're not panicking if you're up a little bit more here and there. It kind of does come out in the wash. But yeah, obviously if you're trending too quickly, you can reduce calories. So you gain slowly. And I'm going to speak it a little bit crass here. I apologize for how this is going to sound, but it's like, just, it'll stick with you. Like, you gain slowly until you feel so fat that you don't want to do this anymore. Like, that's it. There is no, like, you gotta gain for this long. It's like, you will build muscle in proportion to the length of time that you are gaining, the quality of your training, the amount of weight you gain. So it's like, for how long? I don't know. Gain until you feel uncomfortable and you want to stop, right? Most people, and the reason I don't talk about the health aspect of this weight gain is 99.999% of people are going to get uncomfortable with the weight gain before they actually trend to a place where, like, that extra adiposity, that extra body fat is negatively impacting their health. So the technical answer is gain slowly until you get uncomfortable, or that increase in body fat is negatively impacting your health in some way. But, and even in that regard, it's negatively impacting your health, like, probably for the mega short term. So, like, I'm not even so worried about, like, if you're like, hey, I gained, you know, 30 pounds over 2 years. And, you know, maybe at the peak of my bulk, I was a little bit less healthy for, you know, a 6 month, 4 to 6 month period. It's like, all right, like, it's okay. You know, in the pursuit of building muscle, if that's something you did, it's not going to mess with your longevity or anything like that if you, you know, eventually lose the weight and go back to more of a healthy body weight. So for how long, you know, there's no technical answer. The practical answer I'm going to give you is, if you don't gain for at least about 6 months, don't expect to reveal shit after a fat loss phase. Like, just, you don't have to gain for at least 6 months. You can gain for 3 months and then cut, and gain for 4 months and then cut a little bit. Then you can do all of that. But, you know, if you gain for 4 months and then cut for 2 months, and gain for 4 months, cut for 2 months, like, I would tell you that you're going to have to wait multiple cycles of doing that to actually kind of see any real muscle gain. But that's fine. You might prefer doing that. That might help you stay a little bit leaner throughout that process. But yeah, you're going to have to run that for multiple cycles. So it comes down to personal preference. I think if you don't want to keep flip-flopping between bulking and cutting, I like long, slow bulks. I do. I have a slight bias towards that, but I have a couple clients right now doing, let's say, 4 months in a surplus and then 2 months in a deficit. And we're going to run that for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 cycles until we were like, yeah, we're seeing some results, some fruits of our labor. Cool. Next question. How to transition from a cut to maintenance? Yeah, there's a million ways to do this. I'm going to give you the real spark notes of this. At the end of your cut, your calories are obviously, you're either still in a deficit or you've adapted to those calories and you've kind of hit a plateau and you just don't feel like pushing further anymore. I would have an idea of where your new maintenance is, and you can use, I would use your data. So if you're 200 pounds and you were eating 3000 calories and now you're 175 pounds and now you're eating, let's say, 2250 or something, you can use that kind of math and the ballpark to say, you know what? I lost 25 pounds. My new expected maintenance is probably around 2700 or something like that. And use the data from your tracking and your body weights to make a ballpark guess for where you think your new maintenance is after you've lost weight. Once you have that ballpark of where you think you'll end up, which you have derived from the data from your cut. It's like, I was losing a pound a week when I was eating 2000 calories. So that means you were, like, roughly at that time in a 500 calorie deficit. So maybe maintenance is around 2500. All of those, you can kind of reverse engineer from your own data where you think your new maintenance is going to be. You don't know for sure. And if you want to kind of double check with a calorie calculator, you can. The problem is your specific data that's specific to you and the way that you track and your genetics and all of that stuff is going to be more accurate than a calculator that doesn't know that stuff. So you can use a calculator to help you, but I would not kick and scream if the calculator ends up being something that doesn't work for you. Yeah, I would. At 99 out of 100 times, I'm pulling up my client's data sheet and we're looking at how fast were you losing at this many calories? What's a calorie amount that you've maintained with at a different body weight? And we use that to make an educated guess. So once you have that number, let's use the same example. Let's say you finish your cut eating 2,000 calories and you think your new maintenance is going to be 2,500. So what I would recommend doing is jumping halfway there. Again, there's a lot of different contexts here. This is usually somebody who is feeling okay and they're feeling all right. They're not with crazy diet fatigue. I mean, the worse your client feels, the faster you should add more calories. So if somebody's like, hey, I feel okay at the end of my deficit, obviously I want more food, but I feel okay. I really don't want to gain excess body fat in this process. I really want to keep as much fat off as I practically can. Then I would take, again, this is a ballpark. I'm not going to say this again. This is something that's very individual with the client, but here is a place that I can start on a podcast in a 2-minute answer. Find your expected maintenance, make an educated guess. Take the calories you're currently eating and jump halfway between that and your new expected maintenance. Almost certainly that won't be a surplus. Almost certainly you'll either still be in a deficit or, you know, you'll have at least some element of metabolic rate creeping up a little bit. And from there, you assess biofeedback and the data. If you are not gaining weight and you're still really hungry, chances are you need to eat more. If you are gaining weight and you feel pretty satisfied and satiated, maybe you hold steady. The closer you get to where you think you'll end up, slow down. Combine biofeedback, how you're feeling, with the data to decide if you should keep going. If you're maintaining your weight over a 2 to 4 week period and you're still really hungry, I would say, okay, the data's telling us that you're at maintenance-ish, but your biofeedback's telling us that maybe you could eat more, maybe you should eat more, maybe you're not even at maintenance yet. And so we take the biofeedback plus the data to help us guide the choices that we make. Next question. What muscle gains can be made in maintenance as somebody who's been lifting about a year? A lot more. Like when I say a lot, I mean a meaningful, practical, tangible, visible amount. Yes, your ability to build muscle at maintenance goes down dramatically after that newbie phase. Let's call it the first 2 years of training. But some recent research has shown even in highly advanced trainees, if you check all the boxes, if you're training really hard, you're eating enough protein, you're getting enough sleep, you're truly eating at maintenance calories, you can still build muscle. You asked me essentially how much, and it's impossible to give you like a numerical amount, but I would say somebody who's only been lifting for a year probably still has in what I would phrase as a visible, tangible, practical amount of muscle that they can still build at maintenance. Again, if they're training hard with enough volume, consistently with enough protein, getting enough sleep, prioritizing recovery, I still think that there's a tangible amount of muscle they can build without, you know, getting to a point where it's like, hey, if I really do want to get bigger, I probably need a surplus. Truth is, everybody can recomp. We've seen highly advanced trainees build muscle at maintenance, but it gets much, 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 much slower the closer you get to your genetic ceiling. Next question, how to move from tracking to more mindful, intuitive eating? Yeah, there's a million different ways to do this, and it comes down to the individual a ton. So I'll give you some of what comes to mind for me, but this is something that I work with one-on-one people all the time, and it takes different routes and iterations all the time. What I would say to people is that a couple of things. Number one, there is an element of, hey, dude, just keep doing what you were doing. Like most people who are trying to move from tracking to mindful intuitive eating are people that have been tracking for long enough that they have built a lot of consistent habits. They eat similarly on the day-to-day. They eat similar meals at similar times. And so if you just keep doing that, right, they build meals with similar principles. It's like, keep doing that. You know, I'll have clients start by just taking 1 or 2 days off per week from tracking. And I'm like, on those days, just do what you would do anyway. Just don't track it. And one of the big things I think people forget is you can still use a food scale. I am not somebody who thinks the food scale is inherently disordered or something. Like, I haven't tracked in 7 years. 7 years? How old am I? 33? About 5 years I haven't tracked. I use the food scale every day. Every day, because I know that I want, you know, roughly 50 grams of protein per meal. I'm going to get on my high horse about this. Like, you can still use the food scale thing. Like, when I'm like, I just now, I had a yogurt bowl with like whatever, honey and a banana. When I'm portioning out that yogurt, I don't feel the need to eyeball it. To me, I'm like, I don't want to think about the portion size. I want 500 grams of that oatmeal, or Jesus Christ, that yogurt, because I know I want roughly 50 grams of protein. So like, keep using the food scale. The food scale is great. I mean, keep doing the stuff you were doing before. Keep using the food scale to help you kind of build appropriate portions. I know that when I make a sandwich, I want like 5 ounces of turkey on that sandwich. So I measure it out. There's nothing disordered about doing that. You don't have to get to a point where you're eyeballing everything. Like, the point of tracking kind of is to understand portion sizes. And now you can eyeball when you have to, maybe when you go out, you're at a potluck, you're at a barbecue, you're at a wedding. If you, now you kind of understand how to build a plate when you don't have a food scale, you don't have a tracking app. But like, man, it kills me when people are like, what do I can still use the food scale. I'm like, yeah, of course you can. I want, like, your life, your habits, the foods you eat, the way you build meals should not drastically change from when you are tracking in an app to when you're not tracking. Like, tracking, I get it. Listen, there's a little bit of like a Hawthorne effect where like tracking and having a coach does affect your decisions, right? I mean, I'd be lying to you if I didn't believe that having to put it in an app doesn't affect some people's decisions. But you asking this question, you've probably been doing it for years. So if you just stopped putting it in an app and you just did everything that you normally do, from what you're eating, the way you build meals, when you eat, you know, you're probably going to be better off than you think. So many of my clients live in fear of stopping tracking. And it's only when they stop, when they give themselves an opportunity to practice not tracking, do they realize how many good foundational habits that they've built that are protective against weight gain, that are protective against, you know, going kind of AWOL, chaotic eating. It's like, you can still use a food scale. You can still make the choices you've been making. Right? I bet you the person asking this question, if I tell you to go make your breakfast that you normally make, you can make it out of memory to the, you know, weighing stuff out, ballparking, two kiwis, I got a yogurt, I got a tablespoon of peanut butter, whatever. I bet you can do better than you think. So whether you need to go cold turkey with 0 days tracking or not, that might be a little fast, but I would take a couple days out of the week to not track and challenge yourself to have the same day. I mean, your day, whether you track it or not, should be very similar. Tracking should no longer be the thing that is making you make certain decisions. Tracking is a tool for dialing in, hardcore dialing in portion sizes, right? Hardcore dialing in portion sizes. It's not a tool that should dramatically be changing the principles with which you eat and live. And so In the beginning, when you're just getting into tracking, yeah, the act of tracking will by itself affect your behaviors, right? The act of, you know, what gets measured gets managed sort of thing. But when you've been doing this for a very long time, the tracking becomes what it kind of always should have been, which is just a way to kind of monitor what you're doing, you know, learn about portion sizes, learn about calories and protein, sometimes macros, fiber. And I bet you people who have been tracking for a long time would do really well without putting it in the app. You can keep using a food scale. You can keep making the meals that you were making. You can keep building the meals in the way you were making them. And so that's my, you know, 5-minute rant on that. We're going to go through a couple more. I'm going to keep these to 30 minutes. That's my, maybe I'll do a second episode later in the week with some of these questions. Next question is a weird one. It said, can we be besties? I'm good. Can you please explain, let's make this the last one. Can you please explain when building your own program, the science behind the order of exercise selection? Obviously, the first exercise you do will have more strength. By the time you get to the last exercise, the muscles will be much more taxed. Should you rotate the order in which you do them? So I'll start by saying, whatever, I'll do a hashtag shameless plug. I have an ebook. It's called How to Program for Hypertrophy, subtitled How to Get Most Things Right. And exercise order is its own chapter. And we talk about that in a way that describes my entire philosophy. There's a link in my Instagram bio. I think it's $19 or something like that. I think it's a good value. We go through every single factor in building a program for hypertrophy, exercise order being one of them. So there are a couple facts. The things you do earlier in the session, like the question asker said, things you do earlier in the session, you will get more results from because you'll be more fresh, you'll have better performance, and you'll get more out of them. So let's go through a couple of buckets. And There will be competing thoughts here. So let's go through some true statements. You want to do things earlier in the session that train muscles you want to primarily grow. If someone's like, I want to grow my glutes, and that is my number one goal in life, don't put RDLs, hip thrusts, glute leg presses, Bulgarian split squats at the end of your program. So we want things you care about more, and that could be care about in terms of strength, could be care about in terms of it works a certain muscle group that you want to grow, put that stuff earlier in the session, right? And then on the flip side, stuff you care about less, you can put later in the session. Now, I don't want to make it seem like the stuff in the beginning gets an amazing benefit and the stuff at the end gets just no stimulus whatsoever. I think if you layer on a bunch of these different programming principles, you can still get a really good stimulus throughout the whole workout. But it is true. It is true. Like, I mean, it just makes logical sense. Do the shit you care about more earlier when you're more fresh, period. The second thing is, let's say, neurological complexity. How complicated is the movement? How much stability does it require? How difficult is the technique? So if you're in a hypertrophy program, there aren't many neurologically complex exercises. What I mean by that is we're not doing things like clean and jerks. You're not doing things like plyometrics. You're not doing things like snatches that are really neurologically complex, that they're very technique heavy, and you really need to be like neurologically dialed in for that stuff. But we do have some things like a barbell back squat, like a bilateral RDL, that even things like split squats that do have some neurological complexity. The later you are in your session, you want to be training more stable exercises. The earlier in the session, you want to train less stable, more neurologically complex stuff. Put your, you know, let's say you're doing barbell back squats and leg presses in the same session. Do the barbell back squats first when you're more fresh neurologically. Do the very high stability leg press later, right? You know, the barbell back squat requires a lot of core demand. Do that earlier in the session and then go to your leg press, which doesn't require any core in terms of you just creating, you know, abdominal stability, whatever. So move from greater neurological complexity and lower stability to lower neurological complexity and greater stability. You could say that a proxy for that is moving from compound to isolation, but that isn't always the case. But moving from compound to isolation might also have some logic. The problem is leg press is compound. So I care more about how technique dominant, how much core involvement, how complicated is the technique, all of that stuff. I want to do that stuff earlier in the session. I want to do my higher stability stuff, maybe my isolation exercises, later in the session. There's another argument for training the short position of a muscle earlier in the session, because that is where we fatigue first. And when you fatigue there, you can still work really well in longer length at longer lengths. So working from short to long also has some logic. So now we have stuff you care about more earlier in the session. We have neurologically complicated stuff, neurologically complex stuff that lacks stability, compound exercises earlier in the session. We have short position work earlier in the session. And obviously the opposites later in the session. And so those things will come in conflict, because you might have a program that says, I want to do RDLs, then 45 degree, or let's just say not in order. You have a workout that says RDLs, again, not in order, RDLs, hip extension, lying hamstring curl, and a Bulgarian split squat. So we have RDL, hip extension, Bulgarian split squat, whatever, seated ham crawl. I don't even know if that's what I said the first time around. But there are many defensible ways to organize that workout. You could say, I'm doing the hip extension first. Hip extension is going to challenge the glutes in a more short position, and I'm going to start with short, and I'm going to work into my RDLs, right? I personally don't like doing that. I most highly rank neurological complexity as the thing I really want to get done early in the session. I'd rather, because the RDL challenges the glutes and hams and in more lengthened position, I don't care about that priority. That's not a priority for me, working from short to long. I really, most often, I prioritize neurological complexity and stability. And so I will do the complicated shit, maybe the free weights, the complicated techniques, maybe the stuff that people care about earlier in the session, and I'll move to, you know, lower priority muscle groups and isolation work and high stability stuff later in the session. So hopefully that helps. I would organize that leg day with either the RDL or the Bulgarian first. I'd probably do those two first, then the hip extension, then the seated ham curl, let's say. But you could come to me and say, Jordan, you know what? I'm going to do the hip extension first, then I'm going to do the Bulgarian, then I'm going to do the RDL, then I'm going to do the seated ham curl. And there's an argument there. And so the other question that you said was, should you rotate the order in which you do them? I would not rotate them within a program, but you might rotate the priority muscle groups over the course of time. You might say, for the next 6 months, I'm really prioritizing glutes. I'm going to put that stuff earlier in the session. And in my, you know, in the four to six month block after that, I'm really prioritizing quad work. I'm going to put that stuff earlier in the session. You could operate that way. You could operate that way if your priorities do change, right? If your priorities do change. So I would only rotate the order in which you do them primarily if priorities change. If you're like, hey, I'm doing an arm specialization block where I want my biceps and triceps to absolutely blow up, well, do them earlier in the session, 100%. If that isn't your priority, I would put them later in the session. I would do the compound pressing and pulling earlier in the session and finish with a little bit more elbow flexion, extension, isolation exercises, a little bit higher stability. So hopefully that gives you some insight into the way my brain works with some of this programming stuff. I'll close off this whole Q&A and this question by saying the order doesn't matter that much. Like, it matters a little bit. It does. It totally does. You'll get better results from your RDL if you do them first versus if you do them last. But if you took a program and person A does it in the most logical order that I just laid out, and person B does it in the least logical order that I just laid out, but they both train every session with enough intensity, enough sets, they never miss a workout, whatever. They both do the same amount of workouts with the same amount of intensity, all that stuff. I bet you they look basically identical at the end of 10 years. So I just want to put it into context. You're going to be doing this stuff for a long time. Don't necessarily get lost in the weeds. And if you show up and you're supposed to start with glute bridge, and you like doing it in the Smith machine, but there's like four people camped out on the Smith machine, just do it later. It's going to be okay. I tell people in my group all the time, yes, I program this stuff in this order for a specific reason. But if that's getting in your way of getting it done in the time that you have allotted because people are hogging a certain machine and you feel like you have to wait to do it in order, do not wait. Do not wait. Go do something else. Come back to it later. And the next week, you can go to the order that I prescribed. And again, if someone's taking it, no problem. I would rather you get everything done, train hard with intensity, and be able to actually do the workouts because you're not wasting 10 minutes waiting for something just because you need to be doing this in order, is absolutely how I would describe it. I'll take the person who got in 200 workouts per year but had to change the order sometimes versus the person who got, you know, 170 workouts in because a couple of them took too long that she had to go home because she was waiting for the leg press and blah, 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 blah. So again, hopefully that was helpful. If you guys want to learn more about how to program for hypertrophy, I have an ebook, $19, $19.99, $20. In my bio, I find it to be super, super helpful. I'm staring at one of my clients made me a hardcover copy, which I absolutely love. Means a ton to me. So cool. And if you do read that book, and if you ever want to reach out and you want to ask me a question about the book or say, you know what, I think I would do this differently, I would love to have that be a very fun, spirited conversation. So I'll probably get one or two of these Q&A episodes done per week. I find them quite enjoyable. I know you guys do too. And so I appreciate it. And I will see you in the next one.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Where Optimal Meets Practical. If you liked the episode, it would mean the world to me if you posted a screenshot to your social media or left a 5-star review on iTunes. That stuff really helps. If you ever want to get in touch with me, just shoot me a DM on Instagram @JordanLipsFitness. I'm always around to chat. Thanks, guys. Have a good one.